refusing to tell the truth. The WHO itself was branded by Trump as a, quote, puppet of China. The Chinese government has dismissed Western allegations, saying the virus might have begun outside of China. Trump is now gone, but the White House is keeping up pressure on Beijing. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki expressed concern this week about what she called misinformation coming out of China. Beijing has warned against any negative speculation and politicized interpretation of the fact-finding mission. Will the WHO scientists be able to carry out their investigation properly despite all the political pressure?
Obviously, the scientific medical investigation may help for future prevention or development of science in terms of understanding how viruses change and how the pandemic started and how the new virus originated. Obviously, among scientists, or at least the majority of scientists, believe what happened is a natural mutation of the virus.
Observers believe that the scientists should be allowed to complete their work independently because the results could prove vital for the future of mankind.
What was planned by the Dutch government as a system to prevent the rapid spread of the COVID-19 virus in the Netherlands has turned sour, as it seems that the curfew imposed has been met with staunch opposition, with four nights of rioting taking place across the country, causing shops to be looted, infrastructure to be damaged, and police having to react to contain the disturbance. With police facing rioters on the front line, water cannons, CS gas, and other forms of police force have had to be deployed, resulting in hundreds of arrests being made and fines allocated to those who break the curfew rules. Yet it seems after four nights of violence involving a crowd formed by a majority of youths, the police have managed to take hold of the situation as protests have died down as the consequences of the actions of the rioters are being met with a tough stance by the police and the government. In fact, the reaction by the Dutch government is one of anger, as it claims that all damage will be paid for by those responsible. A tough task to apply, but something that the government of Mark Rutte is keen to go through with, as echoed by the Dutch finance minister, who has labelled the rioters as scum. Many of the protests and rioters are complaining about the measures being taken by the Dutch government when it comes to containing and dealing with the virus, claiming a curfew still does not eradicate the virus. But many in the Netherlands do not agree with the protests, stating that only a small minority of people are causing so much trouble.
Well, we're very sorry about it. It's just really unfortunate, actually. I have a feeling that most of these people, not all of them, some are genuine protesters against corona rules, right? But most of them are just people who usually attend football matches and just are looking for rioting, etc. And that's really unfortunate. I mean, that's just not what all of the Netherlands is. I mean, this is just like 0.1% of population, or maybe 0.01% of population. It's very unfortunate that it gets such a lot of international attention.
With a country very much like the rest of Europe, impatient to get the vaccines rolled out, hence allowing life to return to some kind of normality, it remains to be seen what will happen until then. However, deep in the mix of the protests, yet still visible enough to be seen, it seems that the protests and riots are a stage for another form of demonstration in the Netherlands, one that may yet again rise its ugly head in the near future. Many countries across the world have seen the effects of the pandemic affect their social well-being, causing many people to reach boiling point, as over 12 months of hardship has seen the world change the way it performs, even the most benign of duties. Yet worryingly, in the Netherlands, pockets of protests have included political groups, which most concerning of all, contain far-right movements, with evidence suggesting that the Dutch branch of the German-born Pegida ideology has been counted amongst the protesters. The Netherlands has a strong far-right influence in its political parties, and this has been reflected by some far-right politicians calling on the Dutch military to step in and protect the streets of the country against the rioters, something that suggests the current plan to control the situation by the police may just not be enough, in spite of a calmer last day or two. But the Netherlands, as we know, has a strong anti-immigrant and in particular anti-Muslim following, inspired by the likes of far-right leader Geert Wilders, who in his past rhetoric has made his feelings very clear about certain communities living in the country.
Look at the Islamization of our country. If a Dutch person driving in a car drives 5 miles too fast, he will be fined within a minute. Whereas the Moroccan scum in Holland, and once again, not all are scum, but there is a lot of Moroccan scum in Holland who makes the streets unsafe. Mostly young people. And they are not taken seriously. We are making them and the people unsafe, and that should change.
With far-right groups such as Pediger now emerging in the shadows of the protests, could this openly public sentiment fall into the hands of far-right leaders, such as Geert Wilders, who may use the surge in feelings to fuel his campaign to bring the far-right up another notch on the political spectrum, especially as the Dutch are due to face an upcoming election following the resignation of current Prime Minister Mark Rutte following a welfare payment scandal. There's no doubt that far-right groups across Europe are still very much in place, and although the COVID-19 virus has played its part on diverting attention away from politics for now, could the example seen in the Dutch protests and riots be the catalyst for other far-right groups in Europe to jump on the bandwagon and politicise the virus to their own benefits?
January 26th is remembered by many Australians as a national day, with many celebrating the occasion with pomp and show to mark the anniversary of the 1788 arrival of a group of British ships called the First Fleet at Port Jackson in New South Wales and the raising of the British flag at Sydney Cove by Arthur Phillip. The part of the celebrations was hoisting an Australian flag over Sydney's Opera House and displaying the word Austay on the sky over the Sydney Harbour. But the celebrations of the origins of a modern nation are a time of mourning for Indigenous Australians who have endured discriminations despite inhabiting the land for centuries. They view the arrival of British settlers 200 years ago as the beginning of pain and suffering. They even brand the Australia Day as Invasions Day. That's why thousands of people, mainly Indigenous, defied coronavirus restrictions on Tuesday and took to the streets in several cities to highlight their plight. Some protesters chanted a slogan such as "Sovereignty was never ceded" and "No justice, no peace," while others held up placards reading "Not a day to celebrate" and "Black lives matter."
It's very important because the issues that we're facing here in Australia are not going to go away overnight. So until we start getting justice and start seeing change in this country, we will not stop. This will be continuous. We no longer call it Australia Day, it is now Invasion Day. Always was and always will be Invasion Day.
But why do Indigenous Australians view this auspicious day as Invasions Day?
There's a much wider recognition these days of the 26th of January as an invasion day or a survival day, because at least for the last generation or so, younger people have learnt that the colonisation of this country was not simply a matter of settlement. It was a matter of brutal dispossession. It was a matter of genocide. It was a matter of trying to obliterate the culture of Indigenous people here. And at least for the last 30 or so years, there's been a recognition every year and some greater recognition in schools and universities of that sort of history. So there is now, as a result, this very strong tension between the ongoing celebration of colonization called Australia Day and the recognition of survival or Invasion Day, which is an important educative influence over younger people in this country.
Australia Day, which was formally declared a national holiday only in 1994, has increasingly heightened heated debates in recent years. The occasion is staunchly defended by right-wing commentators and retains strong support from the country's conservative government. Prime Minister Scott Morrison believes history changed forever in 1788 and that there was no escaping or cancelling that fact. He says for the better and worse, it was the moment where the journey to modern Australia began. But federal opposition leader Anthony Albanese has a totally different reading of the whole historical journey. This is Australia Day, is the one Australians need to acknowledge that it has been a very difficult day for the First Nations people.
In the first instance, it's important for us to recognise our own history and the consequences of our own history and the fallout of that colonisation and dispossession, and the way in which the non-Aboriginal communities benefited from that and still benefit from that, and the ongoing enormous social advantage against Indigenous people in this country, which far outweighs that of any other community. So if we don't understand our own history, we can't have a resolution of contemporary problems. Secondly, because Australia is involved in a lot of adventures, a lot of neocolonial adventures in other countries, we can't recognise the problems of that and the problems of our own intervention in other countries unless we understand our own history and the colonisation of our own history.
Australia's Aboriginals currently represent around 3% of the country's population, but the most disadvantaged lot of the society. They are also said to be largely excluded in their limited capacity to participate in the decision-making or even control their own and mainstream social and cultural environment. From forcible separation of children from their families to their being displaced from their land, limited education, and inadequate employment, discrimination has been widely recorded by advocacy groups. But how has the Australian Indigenous population been marginalized even to the present day?
Well, there's been enormous disadvantage. It occurs across the board. For example, Aboriginal people in prison are something like 14 to 15 times overrepresented. In education, there's been enormous disadvantage. In health, there's terrible disadvantage. As I said, there's no other ethnic group or community that is nearly as disadvantaged as Aboriginal people, despite the fact that large amounts of money have been spent on particular programs. But they haven't achieved success because there's a very deep cultural alienation, for example, from the institutions and the educational institutions of Australia.
All in all, what needs to be done is for the Australian government to put an end to the misery of the Indigenous people and take steps to make it not look like they're from another planet.
It's very rare that a former leader publicly criticises or provides advice to his or her successor, and is often something that protocol frowns upon when it's done. However, this has not stopped the former Labour Chancellor and Prime Minister Gordon Brown from doing so, leaving Boris Johnson red-faced in the process. So intense has the criticism been that Gordon Brown has stated that Britain is becoming a failed state, not only through the poor mishandling of various crises by the British government, but also because of the ever-widening and deepening divisions within the British socio-political system. It seems that Brown has placed the blame squarely at the feet of Boris Johnson, suggesting that the Prime Minister is so alienated from the reality in which British people are living that he has lost scope of how British feel on a variety of issues and everyday problems. One of the main reasons for the disparity is the divide between the Conservative Party and the people, a division that's traditionally seen different classes voting for different parties in the UK, with the working class commonly leaning towards Labour and the upper middle class swinging towards the Tories, hence leading to a lack of communication between the ruling party and the majority of people in Britain. One such example of just how divided the UK are as a population is the opinion on Brexit. With such a slim divide between those wishing to leave the EU and remain, the difference of opinion of people across the whole of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and the north of Ireland is already fractured, without raising the notion of nationalism and separatism into the equation. So when the element of nationalism is introduced into the argument, for example, in the case of Scotland, is former Prime Minister Gordon Brown right when he says that the UK is on the verge of becoming a failed state? And if so, just how serious is the problem?
It's obvious that the present system isn't working. When you have one of the constituent nations, Scotland and the other, completely at odds with the capital and the sort of the economic core of the country, then it obviously the system is not working. A political system hasn't just to represent a numerical majority. It has to represent all sectors of society and all regions of a country, and this current system is obviously failing to do so.
Back in 2014, the majority of Scots rejected the idea of having an independent Scotland, for the country was benefiting from EU budgets allocated to its agriculture, economy and education sectors. However, now that Britain has left the EU, Scots see themselves empty-handed and are highly considering rejoining the EU once again. Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon has repeatedly stated that she would push for a second referendum if her party wins a majority in May elections. Sturgeon has insisted on her country's political independence by stating that Westminster's consent to the move is not their priority, for it's for the people of Scotland to choose, and not the lawmakers in Westminster. Latest polls show that nearly half of the people in Scotland are now in favour of an independent country, a figure that's likely to increase even more as Scots see less benefits flow into their country, and Scottish nationalism is significantly on the rise, hence putting the Scottish people much closer to the option of voting for such a move.
Well, yes, because the last referendum they had was under completely different circumstances. Britain was part of the European Union. Scotland and the Scots were very happy Europeans, and they liked it that way. When Britain left the European Union, they were left, defenceless and without allies in the face of an overweening London capital. So, yeah, they're entitled to ask for it. Whether they should get it or not is whether they should is another story. Once the time comes, vote for independence.
Some of the problems that Britain is struggling with in its post-Brexit era and the widening political and social inequality have encouraged other countries within the UK to consider leaving, for they believe that they're better off on their own. Current polls indicate that over half the people of the north of Ireland welcome the idea of holding a referendum on a united Ireland. Also in Wales, people are starting to back the idea of holding a referendum on independence, spelling the inevitable breakup of the United Kingdom in the process. Can Boris Johnson's Conservative government, therefore, reunite a divided Britain? Or has the pendulum swung too far past the tipping point, taking Britain towards a collapsed failed state full of internal division?
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamidi.
Islamidi.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
By the first verse of the Holy Quran,
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Allah will bless you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Protect you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Help you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
So ask His blessings.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His protection.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His help.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salaamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon all our brothers and sisters. You're listening to the Youth Station only on IRIB English Radio. So our topic for today is democratic dealing with the youth. I'm Hasnain and...
Salaamu alaykum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters, boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, other life forms. He is Hasnain, I am Zainab, this is the show. Thank you for being with us. So, democracy toward youth.
You know, I guess it's our dealing, how we deal with the youth. So, like, what parents need to do, like, what they don't need to do.
So, I'm thinking maybe democracy as opposed to dictatorship.
Yeah.
Right? Because a lot of parents, unfortunately, feel they have this dogma that says, my house, my rules.
Mm-hmm.
Though I understand and respect that, you have to understand that your children aren't your tenants.
They're not like your slaves. Yeah.
Exactly. They're not like people who are living in your house for a while and then they're going to move out. That is their house too. It's their home.
Yeah, they're your children. You don't need to take them for granted.
Yeah. It's where they belong. They belong to you. And not belong to you as if they're a possession, but they belong to you as if they rely on you, and not just on you putting a roof over their heads, but you supporting them, encouraging them, loving them unconditionally, telling them everything's going to be okay, and that no matter what happens, they're going to have their homes to return to. But do you think that this democracy toward the youth is something that should only be... Does it suffice for only the parents to have it with their kids, or is it the society's job as well?
It's of course the society's job as well.
How so?
You know, society is, you know, made up with the parents and the youth. So basically, even the society gets involved into this. So we need to, first of all, we need to look that, you know, parents have rights over children, and as well, children have rights over their parents.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah, so, like, Sister Zainab, like, what do you suggest us to do?
For the youth?
Yeah.
I think it's simple. I mean, it's simple, but it's not easy. Mm-hmm. By simple, I mean it's not complicated, really. Mm-hmm. There's a hadith from, whether it's Rasulullah or Amir al-Mu'mineen, alayhi as-salam, I'm not sure, but not that it makes any difference, that the... His Eminence says, basically, you divide child upbringing into three levels, each specified to a set of 7 years. So first 7 years, second 7 years, third 7 years. You do whatever you can in this span of 21 years. And then His Eminence says, when they reach their, when they finish their third 7 years, you leave them. At this point, it doesn't mean that you abandon them, as in you mean whatever you tell them from that point onward doesn't have much of an effect on them anymore.
Yeah.
Because they've already established their personalities and they're set in their ways.
Yeah.
So the first 7 years, now I'm not trying to show that, turn this show into some sort of you know, child upbringing 101 family psychology here in Ireland. No, this is not it. I'm just talking about like my understanding. I don't have kids. But from the teachings of Islam, they tell us the first 7 years, you should let your child do whatever they want. You know, you should, by doing whatever they want, it doesn't mean that, let them have chocolate-covered pancakes for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. But allow them to experiment, allow them to experience, allow them to move and navigate within the safety of their home. Under your supervision, in order to discover themselves in the world.
So we just don't need to, you know, put them inside the four walls.
Yes. Yeah. Confine them to do that. You know some parents, how they are, like they have toddlers and they're like, no, don't touch this. No, don't go on the couch. No, don't write on the wall. No, don't put, don't, like, they don't even let their toddlers eat themselves because they're like, no, you're going to get your clothes dirty.
Okay, so where does the problem lie exactly? You know, it's like, is a problem that parents, you know, control their kids?
Where does it come from? I think it's from the parents' anxiety themselves, and they give their children anxiety.
Yeah, but of course, even parents, they need to control their children, you know, but
there's,
I guess it's about, you know, over-controlling them.
I think there's a difference between controlling and training.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You train your children. You're not supposed to control them. Even the prophets, when they came, none of them... Allah literally said in the Quran, you're not responsible for the deeds and action of these people. You're not you're not their wakil.
Yeah.
Right? You're not their...
They're responsible themselves.
Yeah, they're responsible themselves. You're just here to be a mundir and a mubashir. You're here to warn and give good tidings.
Yeah.
You're supposed to train them. And then they choose whether or not they want to put those trainings into practice. Yeah. I think it's the same for kids.
Yeah.
And when we say democracy towards our youth, I feel like that's what we should be aiming for. To train our children. Where do you think a parent's training toward their kids fails?
Timing?
Uh-huh.
I feel it's the timing. You know, they're just too late in training them. They should have, you know, upbringing. I guess, you know, the problem lies in the upbringing. Mm. You know, they should have trained them at the right time. Mm. And after that, you know, you see people, you know, they go to the scholars. They say, sir, our child, you know, he's not, you know,
praying.
He's not praying and all. Beat anything. Like, he's away from Islam. Mm. What shall I do now? Like, you know, this is not the right time. You should have trained this,
late.
You know, when he was a toddler, when he was a child.
Actually, even before that, Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam says, train your children from the time they are in the wombs of their mother.
Mm-hmm.
And the sahaba are like, but how? Their little fetuses,
the action of the parents?
The food you feed them.
Uh-huh.
The food the mother food. Eats, exactly. Yeah. Halal food is so important. It's one of the pivotal, most significant training tools a parent can provide for their children to an extent where if the child's belly is filled with haram food, they will end up standing against the imam of their time and slaughtering him, like the enemies of Abu Abdullah did.
Yeah.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Can you think of any instances where parents, like from your friends, family, people close to you, acquaintances, where parents were dictators toward their children and how it led to devastating results?
I think that I had few friends that, you know, the parents, you know, they used to completely control them.
Mm.
You know, they were not even allowed to go out with their friends. They were not even allowed to hang out with their friends.
Mm.
It's like whenever we used to call them, they're like, oh, my dad wouldn't agree. So, you know, I guess there's, you know, this over-controlling. You know, there's no problem just to, you know, chill out with your friend. You know, you should at least allow that. So, you know, the devastating thing over here, you know, he's losing his, you know, his teenage. You know, he's just in the house. He cannot go out. He cannot discover new things. There lies a problem.
And what were the results? Do you know those people still? Do you feel like it had damaging results in their life?
Or when they became adults? The result was, you know, not as damaging as we think, but it was a loss to them.
And, you know, when you restrict your children so much, you're basically implying to them that I don't trust you.
You know, what I think is the restrictions should only be, you know, until the limit of Islamic boundaries.
Mm.
You should restrict them, you know, in this scenario, like anything related to Islam, like halal, haram, makruh. You shouldn't allow them to do haram stuff or any makruh or haram act.
Mm-mm.
You know, these should be the restrictions.
Exactly. So within the boundaries of Islam, don't overdo it.
Yeah.
Because it will drive the child crazy. And when you restrict them enough, you are implying to them that I don't trust you.
Yeah.
When you tell them every time they want to go out with their friends, you say no, it means I don't trust your where you're going to go. I don't trust what you're going to do with your friends. I don't respect you enough as a human being.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the child will subconsciously understand and pick up. And that will, I think...
So here the duty of parents is, you know, they should get to know their child. You know, when he grows up, he's a teenager. So, you know, rather than being a father or a mother, they should be their friend.
Mm.
You know, they should get to know them. Like, even if he wants to go out with his friends, they should know who his friends are.
Exactly.
You know, are they good people? Is he having a good company?
Mm-hmm.
Like, he should know about the child itself and even his friends. So then you can take a decision, like, you want to send with them or not.
For sure, absolutely. Something else that I feel parents do...
Okay, so in this topic, so there's another question when we're talking about the parents and the children. So here, generally we get to see that these are two different generations. They're from different times.
Mm.
You know, when these parents, they themselves were teenagers, they had a different time.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're of different times. You know, sometimes we even see that, not just parents, even grandparents, you know, they control their kids, their grandchildren. That's a third generation.
Yeah.
So there's a lot, you know, time difference. There's an age gap.
Yes.
So, how does it impact, you know, on this?
Definitely an issue. I feel it's definitely an issue because each generation has its own requirements, has its own conditions, has its own history, politics, agendas, you know, has its own pop culture that generation understands. And it doesn't necessarily apply to the future generation.
Yeah, so what I guess is dictatorship comes in, like when parents saying that our children should live the way how we live.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
That we might say might be dictatorship.
Yeah, it's definitely a form of dictatorship to force any human being to live the way you do, because you might want what's best for your kids, but you must understand that what's best for you isn't necessarily what's best for them.
Yeah.
They are totally different human beings with different personalities to an extent.
Yeah.
In a different society that has different requirements.
Yeah.
And the best you can do for them is to train them in accordance with their needs and the needs of the society.
Uh-huh.
You know, you can't apply the rules that you grew up with to your children.
Exactly.
Because it's
they're
expired.
They're born in a different time. Yeah.
Exactly. It's expired.
Yeah.
Those rules, and for that time, maybe it worked, maybe it didn't work, but whatever it is, it's done. You move on. You create a new set of rules that you feel will benefit your child the most according to the journey they're supposed to take in life.
Yeah. So, dear listeners, thank you so much for staying with us. And Sister Zainab, thank you so much. So until next time, fi aman Allah.
I am what I am because you made. I have what I have. My love is strong because you are the one I call creator. Omega, my protector and my maker. Because of you, in weakness I am braver. My defender and my savior, my giver and my taker. Abiding in silence with patience and guidance, I will when I need you, the light when I seek you, justice, forgiveness, the strength in my weakness, and my love is strong.
A government agency known as the Congressional Watchdog has issued a new report recently shedding more light on the Trump administration's failed response to the raging coronavirus pandemic. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jessica Corbett Ryder. This article is published under the heading New Government Report Details How Trump Failed COVID-19 Response Across the Board. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. A U.S. government agency known as the Congressional Watchdog has issued a new report recently shedding more light on the Trump administration's failed response to the raging coronavirus pandemic. Over 430,000 Americans had died from COVID-19 by Thursday, January 28, and the country's hospitalizations, though falling, have still topped 100,000 every day this month. The report released on Thursday, January 28, by the Government Accountability Office, GAO, entitled COVID-19, Critical Vaccine Distribution, Supply Chain, Program Integrity, and Other Challenges Require Focused Federal Attention, is the fifth agency analysis of the March 2020 Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security CARES Act. The findings alarmed key lawmakers, including Representative James E. Clyburn, House Majority Whip, and Chairman of the Select Subcommittee on the Coronavirus Crisis. As Clyburn put it, today's alarming report from the Government Accountability Office provides further confirmation of what the Select Subcommittee's investigations have made clear. The previous administration's coronavirus response failed across the board, exacerbating the pandemic's toll of death, disease, and economic harm. The report illustrates how the response was ineffective, lacking a comprehensive testing strategy, and failing to address medical supply shortages, inefficient, bungling the initial stages of vaccine distribution, and equitable, failing to protect workers and leaving federal relief programs vulnerable to significant risk of fraudulent activities, Clyburn said in a statement. Perhaps most disturbingly, the Majority Whip added, today's report revealed that even after GAO made 27 different recommendations aimed at improving the response, the Trump administration failed to implement them. That means only 4 of 31 GAO recommendations have been implemented. GAO remains deeply troubled that agencies have not acted on recommendations to more fully address critical gaps in the medical supply chain, the report says. While GAO recognizes federal agencies continue to take some steps, GAO underscores the importance of developing a well-formulated plan to address critical gaps for the remainder of the pandemic, especially in the light of the recent surge in cases. The former U.S. administration's refusal to act on the agency's recommendations also drew criticism from Benny G. Thompson, chairman of the House Committee on Homeland Security, who said that this report confirms what we already knew. The Trump administration failed to take any meaningful action to improve the federal response to the COVID-19 pandemic during its final month. It's inaction to address critical weaknesses that GAO previously identified, including developing clear and comprehensive plans for testing and vaccine distribution, likely cost lives and created an even bigger mess for the new administration, he added. Clyburn's office highlighted some major findings from the report, that vaccine distribution under President Donald Trump fell short of expectations, as well as his administration's failure to address critical gaps in the medical supply chain or fraudulent activity related to corporate relief programs. Implementation of GAO's recommendation concerning the importance of clear and comprehensive vaccine distribution and communication plans remains a work in progress, the report says. Moreover, slow implementation of GAO's recommendations relating to program integrity, in particular, those made to the Small Business Administration and Department of Labor, creates risk of considerable improper payments, including those related to fraud, and falls far short of transparency and accountability expectations. The report urges the new Democrat-controlled Congress and administration to act on not only the previously ignored recommendations, but also 13 new ones. GAO is pleased that the Consolidated Appropriations Act 2021, enacted in December of 2020, requires a number of actions that are consistent with several of GAO's prior recommendations, including those related to the medical supply chain, vaccines and therapeutics, and COVID-19 testing, the agency adds. GAO will monitor the implementation of the Act's requirements. Thompson expressed hope that the new president will, as he promised on the campaign trail, pursue a more effective COVID-19 agenda. It's tragic. It will take a year and over 400,000 American lives lost for the federal government to take substantive action to take this pandemic seriously.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The necessity to observe health protocols and the regulations announced by the anti-corona headquarters during Muharram morning occasions.
This is part of a televised speech delivered on July 31st, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader of the Islamic Revolution on the occasion of Eid al-Adha.
I wish to say something about Muharram. There are many debates about Muharram. People have been speaking about Muharram for a long time. Well, they will hold the mourning ceremonies one way or another. But what I want to stress is that in the mourning ceremonies, the main criteria is what medical experts, the National Anti-Corona Headquarters, announced to us. I myself will observe whatever action they deem necessary. My firm recommendation to all those who wish to participate in the mourning ceremonies, including mourning committees, those who take the minbar, the organizer, panegyrists, performers of eulogies, and the like, is this. Before you do anything, you should see what they say.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord,
my Lord,
protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
If the National Anti-Corona Headquarters issues certain regulations for these occasions, all of us will have a duty to observe them. The issue is not a minor issue. Rather, it is a very important one. In the present time, there is supervision and control to some extent. However, if God forbid, these measures are taken lightly, and if people do not observe them, then there will be a disaster with unclear consequences at the end. I hope that Allah the Exalted will help. I hope that Imam of the Age, may our souls be sacrificed for his sake, will take our hands and rush to our help, as has always been the case. I hope that the pure souls of martyrs and the immaculate soul of our late Imam, may God bestow paradise on him, will pray for us and ask God to bestow success on the Iranian nation, God willing. Greetings be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Around the World with Reporters.
Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif says it is the duty of the U.S. to return to the 2015 nuclear deal and fulfill its obligations under the accord. In a joint press conference with his Turkish counterpart, Zarif underlined that the moment the United States fulfills its commitments, Iran would be prepared to fulfill ours.
It is the duty of the United States to return to this agreement and to fulfill its obligations. The moment the United States fulfills its commitments, we would prepare to fulfill ours.
Zarif also denounced a U.S. decision last month to slap sanctions on Turkey over the country's purchase of the S-400 Russian air defense system. He said the sanctions have no significance. Elsewhere in his remarks, Zarif hailed relations with Turkey, noting that ties will deepen when the U.S. adopts more reasonable attitudes. For his part, Cavusoglu said, Turkey has always supported the nuclear deal, expressing the hope that the Biden administration would return to the JCPOA and lift sanctions on Iran.
Iran, ABD ve...
I hope that with the Biden administration, the United States' return to this agreement and cooperation on the nuclear issue is restored. In this way, God willing, the sanctions and embargoes imposed on brotherly Iran are lifted.
Zarif arrived in Turkey as part of a tour of countries of the South Caucasus aimed at building support for the creation of a regional platform that would include Armenia, Azerbaijan, Georgia, Iran, Russia, and Turkey, and encourage cooperation between the countries. The initiative was proposed following a ceasefire agreement in November that halted weeks of conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan over the separatist territory of Nagorno-Karabakh.
I think the meeting was very important. Both sides have a lot in common and many issues were discussed regionally and economically. The most important issue on the agenda was the Iran nuclear deal. And now with the new U.S. administration, there is a hope for this deal to be revived.
Zarif also met with Turkish President Erdogan, where the two discussed expansion of bilateral ties, as well as regional cooperation in Syria, Iraq, Caucasus, and ways to restore stability in the region through synergy. This meeting is seen by many as a door to open negotiations between Turkey and the U.S. to revive the 2015 nuclear deal. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Public and private sector workers staged a nationwide 24-hour general strike to denounce government measures adopted to counter the spread of coronavirus disease in Italy. The industrial action, called by the Confederation of Base Unions, COBAS, was joined by public servants and self-employed workers in several cities, including Milan, Rome, and Naples. In a note, unions have explained that the ongoing health crisis has exacerbated a structural crisis of the capitalist economy with a generalized impoverishment and a worsening of living conditions for millions of male and female workers. Also, students and teachers of Italian high schools held rallies in Rome and other cities, demanding a prompt return to the classroom after almost 10 months of remote learning.
We are staging a protest to reiterate that schools must be a priority in this country. Just a small amount of the recovery fund is destined to the school system. Students are sick and tired of distance learning and are dropping out of schools. Many are falling victim to depression.
Students across Italy have been holding demonstrations, open-air lessons and strikes in protest over the adoption of the distance learning policy by the government in response to a second wave of COVID-19 in October. About 10 million students have been affected by coronavirus restrictions in Italy, while schools have remained open in most European countries.
We demand more classrooms, transport to school and better access to education. Distance learning is not working. Many families cannot afford providing digital devices to their children to attend internet lessons regularly. Our families get poorer by the day as our parents lose their jobs.
As if the COVID crisis and its grave effects on the Italians weren't enough, Italy has also been hit by a political crisis with Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte resigning earlier this week, forcing the country's head of state to start a round of formal consultations with all political groups to establish if a new government majority can be formed.
Talks between Italy's President Sergio Mattarella and party leaders to resolve the government crisis concluded on Friday, with the country on the brink of a crashing socio-economic failure. President Mattarella must now decide on the way forward and ensure Italy a new government. Max Civili, Rome.
Israeli occupation has denied COVID-19 vaccine to Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Israeli parliament said Palestinians living under Israeli blockade in the Gaza Strip will receive no vaccine. Palestinians say the move is aimed at pressurizing resistance groups to release Israeli soldiers arrested during the Israeli aggression imposed against the Strip since 2014.
Israel's aggressive policies are unacceptable, and Palestinians will resist these inhumane policies. The Israeli announcement to deny vaccines to Gaza is totally unacceptable. The resistance groups will remain steadfast in their fight against the occupation and have prepared themselves for all possible scenarios.
This comes as Israeli Health Ministry has said over a quarter of Israel's population have received the vaccine since December 19. Human rights groups have accused Israeli regime of violating the basic rights of Palestinians.
Since the coronavirus outbreak in the Gaza Strip, Israeli regime has sought through all possible means to pressurize the resistance groups into sitting back. Israel has announced that no aid is allowed in the Gaza Strip without the release of their captured soldiers. Palestinians will never accept such a thing, and the Israeli occupation knows this well. Israel is now showing its racist face to the world by announcing this illegal and inhumane policy.
For their own part, Palestinian resistance groups in the Strip have said they will not sit back, adding release of Israeli soldiers should come through a just prisoner swap deal.
We announced that the Israeli attempts to pressurize the resistance front into releasing its captured soldiers won't succeed. We are after a fair swap deal. We won't give in to pressure. Israel's attempts to tie vaccine entrance to soldier release will fail.
Earlier, the United Nations called on the Israeli regime to help ensure Palestinians will receive COVID-19 vaccinations amid the coronavirus pandemic, stressing that the pandemic has taken a heavy toll on the occupied Palestinian territories. The UN said the cost of lives and livelihoods there remain high, particularly in the Gaza Strip.
Israel's move to deny vaccine to the Palestinians comes as over 156,000 Palestinians have been infected with coronavirus and more than 1,800 have lost their lives so far. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Joint military drills involving the U.S. and South Korea are scheduled to go ahead this spring, says South Korea's Minister of Defense and military officials under U.S. President Joe Biden. But nearly 400 NGOs around the world have signed a joint statement calling for the drills to be scrapped in the hopes of improving relations with North Korea and promoting a lasting peace. The annual exercises, some of which are computer-simulated war games, are viewed by Pyongyang as a threat and a rehearsal for invasion.
The joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises have been suspended before in the early 1990s as Washington sought to improve relations with Pyongyang. Previous U.S. President Donald Trump also scaled back the drills following his first summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in 2018.
The North's Kim then pledged to suspend nuclear and long-range missile testing, with subsequent meetings between Kim and Trump failing to yield results or much for North Korea in return for its moratorium. U.S.-led sanctions against Pyongyang remain in place. South Korea keeps buying more advanced U.S. weapons, and now more military exercises are planned. Some activists view the war drills as counterproductive.
These South Korea-U.S. joint exercises fail to contribute to maintaining peace. Rather, it has been conducted in a way that threatens peace on the Korean Peninsula. It's now even more important because it's the beginning of the new Biden government in the United States and what signals can give to North Korea at this point.
North Korea has continued developing other military technologies, introducing a submarine-launched ballistic missile at a recent military parade. While seemingly committed to the drills, new U.S. officials have said they're reviewing North Korea policy, as experts call on Pyongyang to be patient. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Will Switzerland ban the burqa? That is the question being asked by many Swiss Muslims ahead of an upcoming referendum, which seeks a total ban on all face coverings in public. If successful, Muslim women who wear Islamic face veils will be banned from doing so after March the 7th.
Now, the text in the proposal doesn't mention Muslim face veils per se, only stating that no one shall wear face coverings in public spaces. However, the group behind the proposal includes members of right-wing political parties who were behind the already successful bid to ban Islamic minarets from being erected across the country in 2009.
In response, local Muslim activists have begun a Save the Niqab campaign to challenge the hate.
Islamophobia is spread in Switzerland as everywhere in Europe. We know that there is a realistic chance for the Niqab ban to